calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Friday, the 21st of September, I believe it is, here in the year 2006. And it's the first hour of our Friday program, time for our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, the only independent member of the House of Representatives and the longest-serving member of the House of Representatives in that body's history. Congressman Bernie Sanders, his website, bernie.org. Yeah, our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there, and you can drop in and say hi. Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here, Bernie. Bernie, usually you and I talk a little bit before we go on the air. This morning we got on a little late. I didn't have a chance to. I'm not sure what's on your list, but just one quick thing I wanted to toss out and get your opinion on. Henry Waxman is pointing out that the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Secretary Jackson, has been awarding contracts based on whether or not people have been donors to the Bush campaign and friends of Bush.
Well, sounds like a fair and objective criteria for the bidding process. I mean, doesn't that seem right to you?
And he's been pulling contracts, actually canceling contracts from contractors who have employees or officers who have donated money to Democrats or spoken out against President Bush, and I think that's against the law.
Oh, I think it might be about against 700 laws. But, you know, Tom, one of the problems that we have with the Bush administration is the word unbelievable, the word outrageous, has lost its meaning. Because every single day we hear another instance of something like what Secretary Jackson is doing. So what you're looking at is an administration that not only is the most reactionary in modern American history, is not only the most incompetent, but along with their friends in the Republican leadership in the House and Senate, is clearly the most corrupt in American history. And there's very little that you can tell me that will shock me, because I'm down there and I see it every single day on the floor of the House. And the only thing that continues, in fact, to shock me is the degree and the complicity that exists between the corporate media and the administration, not only in spinning stories, which is a very important issue, but in choosing to emphasize this story or that story. You will remember a couple of months ago that Karl Rove told us that in the next few months we're going to be talking about terrorism. You recall that?
Oh, yeah. He announced their strategy in advance, as he always does.
Yeah, and Karl was nice enough to tell us what the media would be telling us. Nice. We got a little head start. And, of course, that's what the media has done. So when you talk, you know, one of the issues I want to reinforce, and you and I have talked about this many times, and that's why I'm so excited to be on your show and why I very strongly support progressive alternative radio in this country, enormously important that we get a different perspective out there, is not just the spin that the corporate media provides on stories, as important as that is. It is the degree to which the president and the right wing in this country can decide what we will be discussing, what will be prominent, what will be on the front pages of newspapers, and what we're not going to be talking about. So there are huge issues of consequence to ordinary people not discussed, virtually not discussed. The United States is the only country in the industrialized world that does not have a national health care program that guarantees health care to all people. Now, it is a fair debate. There are some people think national health care is a bad idea. Some people think health care should be used as a commodity. Some people have different ideas as to how we provide health care. It's a good debate. Tom, how many people in America do you think know that we as a nation spend twice as much per person on health care and that we're the only nation in the industrialized world that doesn't guarantee health care to all people? How many people do you think even know that?
I guess it's fewer than 5%.
How often have you seen that issue discussed?
Zero.
All right. The role of trade unionism in standing up and creating a better America in terms of not only workers' protection on the jobs, raising the minimum wage, although obviously it has to be raised a lot higher than it is right now, fighting for all of the things that workers need. How many programs have the listeners ever heard talking about the positive role that trade unionism has played in America? Can you recall?
We don't even have labor papers, labor pages
right.
in our newspapers anymore, Bernie. I mean, it used to be an entire labor section when I was
right.
a kid. Now there's not even a half a page devoted
right.
to labor.
So working, the needs of working people, if you talk about the invisible majority in America, it's the working class of this country. They're gone. No, the only time you see it is if somebody gets drunk and gets arrested. Then we'll see it. Then that's the working class of America. But when people are struggling, working two or three jobs, desperately trying to figure out how they're going to send their kids to college, how they're going to pay for child care, when they're doing all of the things that good citizens do, they're invisible. No one talks about them.
Mm.
You know, Britney Spears, we talk about. Mr. Trump, we talk about. The rich and the famous, we talk about. But ordinary working people who are struggling so hard economically today, they are invisible in terms of the corporate media. So one of the fights, when people talk about the issues facing the American people from a political perspective, when we talk about the economy, and we talk about the need for health care for all people, and we talk about the war in Iraq, and we talk about the environment, the need to move to sustainable energy, and we talk about Social Security and the need to strengthen it and not privatize it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What I also hope people will talk about is corporate control over the media, and understand that you're not going to have a vibrant democracy. You're not going to have a large voter turnout. You're not going to have an informed electorate who are engaging in serious debate about the important issues facing our people unless we see that discussion in the media. And it bothers me very, very much that some of the most important issues facing tens of millions of Americans are virtually not discussed at all. And certainly one of the issues that, as a nation, apparently we're not allowed to talk about is the growing gap between the rich and the poor. And the fact that we have today the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth, and that gap is growing wider and wider. You know, we hear in Washington a whole lot about moral values. Well, I am not sure that greed is a moral value. I'm not sure that it is a moral value to give hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the richest 1% and then cut back on Medicare, cut back on Medicaid, cut back on financial aid for middle-class college families, cut back on nutrition programs. I'm not sure that that is a quote-unquote moral value. But we don't discuss the reality of Washington very often in that perspective.
Well, and in fact, in the next hour on this program, I'm going to open the next hour with a debate with Alex Epstein from the Ayn Rand Institute, who is suggesting, and they're the Alan Greenspan was inducted into that organization back in the 1950s in Ayn Rand's apartment in New York, and they're the thinkers behind the libertarians and the modern-day conservatives,
right.
And he's going to be suggesting that actually it is immoral to have a minimum wage,
right.
And that it is immoral to have Social Security, and that basically we should be rugged individualists. And I'm going to say, no, we're a nation of barn raisers. You know, we got together as communities, not as rugged individualists.
But to tell you the truth, I mean, you and I categorically disagree with that extreme libertarianism, but at least that's an intellectual thought, and I'm glad that it's out there in the open. These guys believe the government should play virtually no role in our lives. And if I can hire you for $2 an hour or 50 cents an hour, hey, that's the way life is. Government shouldn't intervene and make sure that you have at least a minimal standard of living and a minimum wage. But what goes on in Washington is the leadership is not that honest and straightforward. The truth is, if you talk to members of the House privately and quietly, you will find that a vast majority of them, of the House, of the Republican members, a majority of them would agree with this gentleman and would abolish the minimum wage. But they know that 90% of the American people would disagree with them, so they don't say that. The way they deal with that issue is simply not raise the minimum wage.
Right.
So you
keep, keep it so low it's irrelevant.
That's right. That's exactly right. So it becomes irrelevant. But what we need as a nation is to focus on the real issues. You know, I get around the state of Vermont a whole lot. And just there's not a day, literally, not a day that goes by that you don't hear from somebody in terms of the real problems, not only impacting that person, but usually multiplied by millions. I mean, just last night, see a woman, her husband, her father, just last night was diagnosed with cancer. They don't have a whole lot of money. She works very hard. Right, what kind of additional financial burden is now on that family? How do they pay it? You talk to working people where the husband and wife are both working, want the best for their kid, want good quality child care. In the state of Vermont, and I suspect in most places in America, almost impossible to find good quality child care at an affordable price.
Right, so that you can work.
And feel good about it, knowing that your kid is well taken care of. God knows how many kids in this country who are 2 years old, 3 years old, and are sitting in front of some television watching TV for 6 hours a day.
Yeah, and then we wonder why when they get to school they don't do well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Amazing. Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. We'll be taking your calls right after this break. Our number 1-866-440-8466. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. We'll be right back. 16 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
The world goes on, no end in sight. Missions accomplished, everything's all right. He's busy reading my pet joke. How the hell did he get your vote? Never saw the weapon, that's what the experts say. But W wasn't listening, let's call him anyway. While you're searching under every stone and log, he merely had a prisoner chained like a dog. Never saw no weapons, that's what the experts said.
No, we never saw no weapons, that's what the experts said about Iraq. Welcome back, 21 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, news without conflicts of global corporate interest. By the way, there's a piece I wrote called Reclaiming the Issues, Keeping George Out of Jail, right up at the top of commondreams.org today. For those of you who follow such things, you can check it out. Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment.
Tom, I want to ask you a question.
Sure.
Where do you get the time to write? Don't you have a 24-hour day like the rest of us?
I'm a pretty quick writer, Bernie. It took me about an hour and a half to write that thing yesterday. But
I'm always amazed.
I do it on the weekends. And
you got to teach me how you do it. It takes.
Yeah.
I'm a slow writer. It's very arduous. But
my easy answer, and there's actually a germ of truth to it, is that I'm a hyperactive kid who grew up, and I'm still hyperactive. That's why I wrote several books about it, I guess, and why my son was diagnosed with ADD. It's because it runs in the family.
There you go. But you're using it for good purpose.
Okay. And that's the point of my books, is, you know, how you can become functional. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And by the way, Bernie, you probably know this just as well as I do. The show business is full of people with ADD.
Right.
Probably
right.
Politics is too.
Right.
Greg in Danville, California, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Congressman Sanders, a real pleasure to speak with you.
Good to talk to you, Greg.
I've got one question, and I'll go ahead and take it, listen off the air. You mentioned before about the corporate control of the media, but my concern is about the corporate control of the elections. And if and when, hopefully, you get elected to the Senate, what are you going to do to push some legislation about campaign finance reform and even address the electronic voting? Tom talked about the horrific Princeton study about the Diebold machine with the viruses. So that's just my question, and I'll take it off the air. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Very important question. Right now what's going on throughout this country is big money, to a very significant degree, controls what happens in the political process. And I should think that people like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, and these guys who wrote our Constitution and who founded our great country, are turning over in their graves when they're finding in state after state that elections are being bought by people who just have huge sums of money and are piling on 30-second television ads. So to my mind, it goes without saying that we need strong campaign finance reform, which essentially says a couple of things. Number one, it says that elections are not for sale and are not going to go to people who just are very, very wealthy or take money from people who have huge sums of money. And number two, that all people should have the opportunity in an election to get their points of view out. So I think the conclusion that we have to reach from that is that we need to move to public funding of elections. We're seeing some states, Maine, Arizona, or two, that come to point that are in fact doing that, and I think doing it pretty successfully. In terms of the election machines, well, it's interesting, probably for political reasons, but the Republican governor of Maryland. Tom, I don't know if you saw this.
Yeah. They had a meltdown with their systems in the primary.
Right. They're spending millions of dollars on their very sophisticated system, and they still haven't counted all the votes from their primary. And he says, let's go back to paper ballots. Well, I'll tell you this. I'm on legislation in the House that would provide a paper trail for any touchscreen voting machine. But we may want to even go further than that. And what we may ultimately want to say, if, as the Princeton people tell us, it is possible, and I don't want to get paranoid and tell you that it has happened. I think sometimes there's a degree of paranoia out there. But if people do not have confidence that the votes that they cast are being accurately counted, then I would, in fact, prefer to go back to paper ballots, take a little bit more time, but at least the whole country, no matter what your political point of view may be, knows, gee, I cast my vote, it was accurately counted, I feel okay about that.
Right.
So I would be safe rather than sorry. I would be conservative on this issue. The most important goal of this is to make sure that the American people feel 100% confident that their votes were accurately counted.
Well, and then there's the third issue, and that is that if the government decides to privatize the concessions at Yellowstone, you know, arguably that's wrong, but that doesn't really endanger American democracy. But when they privatized our vote, handed it over to private corporations, that's part of the commons that never should have been privatized.
No, that's absolutely correct.
I mean,
so I think there's a lot to be discussed. There's no place that I go when I don't talk to people for 5 minutes where that issue was raised. And that's not a good situation. People
yeah.
in America should not have doubts about whether their votes are being accurately counted.
It's just not good for America. Bernie, we have to take a break in just about 15, 20 seconds here, but I'm curious, in short form, your take of the debate on the whole torture issue in the Senate, if you want to get into that a little later on.
Well, all we can say is that the idea that this president is going to continue to embarrass us before the entire world, continue to lower the esteem that the United States has held in the entire world by suggesting that we should revise the Geneva Agreement is beyond belief.
Yeah, it truly is. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls right after the break. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org is his website. Congressman Bernie Sanders of Vermont, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. I think of him as America's congressman. That's why we have him on the program every week. Live with us right here. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You got to fight for your rights. You can't throw your head in the sand. You got to fight for your rights. You can't just bury your head in the sand. Politics and religious superstition go hand in hand.
And welcome back. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, Viagra for your brain. Just don't tell Limbaugh, he'll want some. Welcome back to our program. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. By the way, just a quick tip for those of our listeners in the Los Angeles area. Next weekend, the weekend following this, September 30th on Saturday, I'll be in Pasadena at Roman's Bookstore at 4 p.m. signing my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. And also on Saturday at 8 p.m. in Hollywood at the Bodie Tree Bookstore at 8 p.m. signing the same book. So you can I realize we're running an ad that says "Get Screwed" by Tom Hartman. And a few people have sent me emails going, "Do you know that the ad says that?" I'm like, "Yeah, we know that." Anyhow, it's Bernie Sanders with us, our Brunch with Bernie segment. And, Bernie, let's get back to the phones here. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you're live with Bernie Sanders. Rick?
Who are two of America's treasures.
Well, thank you.
But, you know, Bernie, I was listening to your analysis there of the working class, and Tom, you mentioned, too, how there's no labor coverage in newspapers. But, you know, I'm going to say this, and I hope it doesn't sound too condescending, but the working class, I think, is partially responsible for this. A lot of them don't vote. A lot of them aren't in unions because I guess they think the union is somehow subversive or un-American. And, of course, a lot of them are fooled by Republican propaganda. They somehow thought, a lot of them, that Al Gore was going to take their guns away, John Kerry was going to take their Bibles away. And then, of course, we got Karl Rove scaring everybody into thinking that only the Republicans can protect us from terrorists. I mean, how do we get through all this fog of disinformation?
Well, Rick, you raise some very important issues, but it's a chicken and an egg situation. The point that I was trying to make is if people do not see the realities of their lives reflected on television or on the radio, and if they don't get an understanding of why it is that despite an increase in worker productivity, despite an explosion of technology, they are working longer hours for lower wages, why it is that their jobs are going to China and the new jobs they're getting pay substantially less than the old jobs that they had, if people don't get an understanding, A, that this is happening all over the country, and B, why it is happening, then they end up losing interest in the political process and in government because they don't see the connection between their own lives and governmental policy. The result of that, which is certainly something that Karl Rove works very, very hard on, is to suppress voter turnout, is to tell people, or at least give people the message, voting doesn't matter. Look, government can't do anything for you. Government policy doesn't matter. Government is the enemy. So you lost your job to China. You're not going to think the government is going to do anything to change trade policy. You're working for $5.15 an hour. You can't survive. You're not expecting the government to raise the minimum wage. You don't have any health care. You know, you don't expect a national health care program, do you? Government can't do all that stuff. You're on your own. It's you and the big corporations. And that's the message, essentially, that comes out of Washington. And unfortunately, a lot of people end up accepting it because they're not hearing or seeing a different perspective. And the other thing I have to say, Rick, is, and sometimes we don't talk about this enough, a lot of working people are just plain old exhausted. You know, they are working 50, 60, 70 hours a week. They're coming home. They're trying to take care of their kids. They're under tremendous stress. And you know what? Somebody says, you know, get involved in the political process. They say, sorry, I'm exhausted. You know, I've got other things I've got to do. I've got to spend a few minutes with my kids. So you got a combination of factors. But the point of what you're saying is, if the point of what you're saying is that we don't make changes until working people and middle-class people begin to stand up for their rights and fight to change this country in a very different, and make it go in a very different direction so that it reflects the interest of all of us rather than a handful of, you know, multimillionaires, you're right, nothing is going to change unless we are successful in doing that.
Yeah, well said. By the way, let me just toss in a quick welcome. This week, we just started three new affiliates. Welcome to KTNF in Minneapolis, Minnesota, to KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, carrying our national program now, and KQKE, The Quake, in San Francisco. And glad to have you all with us. And speaking of San Francisco, Kip in San Francisco on the line. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Bernie. Good morning, Tom. I'm really angry at the way our leaders are leading us into, you know, leading us by fear. The situation with airport security is so far out of hand now. You not only, you know, can't take any liquids through the checkpoint, you, if you go through the checkpoint and buy a bottle of water inside the airport, you have to drink that before you get on the plane. At what point do we realize that the terrorists have already won? Because we've been forced to change our lives drastically. Even the poor guy shining shoes inside the airport, he can't even bring his lotions in. He can only bring polish in. So this guy who's making hardly any money, he's had to change his life. At what point do we say enough and realize that the odds of us getting killed by a terrorist are extremely remote and stop buying into this and realize that this is exactly what they wanted. This might be exactly what some members of our government want. And I'm starting to think Eisenhower was a genius. Beware the industrial military complex. And love your comments.
Well, Kip, you've raised a number of issues. Let me just say this. I think international terrorism is a threat to this country. And I think we have the obligation as a government to make sure that we do all that we can to protect the American people. And I have to say that in a number of respects, we are not doing a particularly good job, and we can make it less burdensome, if you like, on consumers. For example, this issue of liquid explosives. There is technology out there that can address that issue without having to tell people they can't bring a bottle of water onto a plane, and we have not done that. In terms of cargo inspection, I think we inspect less than 10% of the cargo that comes into this country. So I think we can do a better job and make it less intrusive, less burdensome on inconveniencing and frightening ordinary people. But I think it's a real risk, and I think we have got to be vigilant on this, because the reality is there are people who would do us harm. Having said that, the other point about trying to create a nation of fear so that Bush and his friends think that it is appropriate to collect the telephone calls of millions of Americans against whom there is not one iota of evidence that they're involved in terrorism, or that we can have the NSA tapping people's telephones without legal court warrants, or that we can have government agents going into libraries to find out the books that you are reading or the books that you are purchasing, etc., 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 is certainly not something that any of us should tolerate for one moment. So my own view is, yes, international terrorism is serious business. We've got to protect the people. We need more and better technology to do it in a less intrusive way. But we don't need to become a nation of people who are constantly fearful, who are prepared to abrogate and give up the constitutional rights that make us a free country.
Yeah, Franklin Roosevelt really, really said it well, you know, when he said that, in fact, here it is.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
And amazingly, he said that in 1933. He was talking about the Great Depression. You know, he was not talking about World War II. And
right.
Yeah. Janelle in Seattle, Washington, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Bernie, I love you. You get me so excited and fired up about all these issues. There was a couple things in particular you said this morning that really struck me, and when you were talking about corporate greed and, you know, what kind of moral value is greed, and also the issue with the media, I think one of my biggest frustrations is what the media associate, and this is, you know, the rogue propaganda machine, right, just this association and assumption. It's really just this complete assumption that if you're Christian, you have to be right-wing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's so frustrating to me when I look at the issues going on and, you know, the lack of health care for the poor, mm-hmm. what's happening with our environment, and
mm-hmm.
all the
right.
things.
Right.
It's moral values is
that's
more
right.
associated with the Progressive Party, and why, you know, it's another issue you don't hear in the media, and it's... There just is this assumption, and I actually have heard bashing even on the liberal and progressive side of Christians, which I just hate because I think you're alienating. I'm very liberal and progressive, and I am a Christian, and or any religion for that matter, and I think on both sides you have to be careful.
Well, you raise some very important points, and I think increasingly what you are saying is that people of faith, not only Christians, but Jews and Muslims and others, are beginning to jump into the political fray and are saying to Karl Rove that moral values deal not just with issues of gay rights or abortion, but that in fact moral values have to deal with poverty. There's a lot more reference to poverty in the Bible than there is to abortion, let me tell you that. That moral values suggest that all of our people should be entitled to health care. Moral values suggest that it is not appropriate that some people, the heads and CEOs of large multinational corporations, make 400 times what their workers make. Justice, fairness are moral values, and we've got to make sure that everybody understands them.
Well said. Speaking as a Christian myself, I'm offended when people like Jerry Falwell try to represent me. I'm just not having it. Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment, 45 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be right back with more of your calls.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Do you believe, or you the one to deceive? I'm just trying to find peace while you held up the breeze. Coming through, epidemic, can you cure this disease? You're alive on the line, yeah, you know what I mean. Human beings, created the gun, aiming the buzz for war, assembling troops, hiding.
truth we mourn. Never too late to find yourself reborn. Connecting overseas, the song, where to phone.
So there you have it, my whole life with all its memories. I'm trying to figure out how to set all of my pain free. Sometimes I wish that I could turn the hands of time back so I could rewrite the wrong and put my life back on the right track.
And welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman radio program coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org, his website, 1-866-440-8466, our phone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Kenny in Bradenton, Florida, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, Bernie, what I wanted to ask was, my son is 18. He voted for the first time in this past primary we had here in Florida, and we live in the 13th Congressional District of Florida, and our congressperson has decided to go on and try greater things. I believe my son registered Democrat, so the primaries themselves, as far as the Republican primary is concerned, have little impact on him. But one of the things that three of the five people that were running to get the nomination for Republican primary for Congress down here kept emphasizing that they were all Reagan Republican. And as I looked across at my son, he was born 6 months to the day before Reagan left office. I don't really think that a Reagan Republican, in terms of generational impact, means that much to him, as opposed to me, who was born in 1952 and was very much aware of who Franklin Roosevelt was and what he meant to my life, even though he passed on before I came into this world.
Well, I think I'm not quite sure of the thrust of your question, but what I think Republicans have tried to do is to kind of recreate the Reagan administration and make it somewhat different than it really was and make him into just an extremely successful president, which in my view he most certainly was not. I think generally people think that he was a very nice guy, a straightforward guy, kind of funny guy. But I think if you look at his records and the cuts that he made back to the needs of working people, lower-income people, the kind of deficits that developed in his administration, the Iran-Contra problems later on in his administration, I don't think history will regard him as being one of the great presidents, to say the least, in American history. But I think what you're seeing is Republicans trying to suggest he was what he was really not, and try to create a mythology out of that so that younger generations will look at him in that way.
They're trying to create him as a Camelot kind of thing.
Right.
Dale in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Thanks so much for your show and for your work, you two. I'm really delighted to be here. I want to just ask a question about national media and progressive Democrats. Like, Bernie's, I think, going to be the next senator from Vermont, which I'm thrilled about. I think because he's got a small state and people know him. But how can a genuinely progressive candidate get through the national media gauntlet and not be ridiculed as unelectable?
Well, that is, you raise a very profound question. It's a very important question, and there is no easy answer. And it speaks to the need to develop a progressive media network in America, better use of the internet, better use of cable, and doing a lot of very difficult things, of which this program, by the way, is one part of. Air America is a part of. Other good progressive radio stations are a part of. But we have an enormous amount of work to be done. The truth of the matter is that money talks, and if you don't have the money, it is very, very hard to get your point of view out. We need to work very, very hard to create alternative media. Now, one of the things that we do here in the state of Vermont, in my campaign for the Senate, we have produced two tabloids, which are pretty cheap to produce, by the way, which are going to every household in the state of Vermont. We are knocking on tens and tens of thousands of doors with volunteers and staff people. What we have to do is revitalize grassroots politics, where ordinary people are involved, ordinary people are communicating with other people, and sometimes that doesn't take a whole lot of money. But it is very difficult. It requires a level of organization that does not exist in many parts of America. But this is an issue, definitely, that if we do not tackle, we're certainly not going to be successful politically, because the other side has so much money and just can put so many 30-second negative ads on, which, in fact, have an impact on the body politic.
Gwyneth in Eugene, Oregon, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi. I want to thank both of you for the work that you do. And I wanted to get out a piece of information, which I'm sure that you're already aware of, Bernie. But as a result of Medicaid cuts in the state of Oregon, and I know that this is also true in many other states, but I know only about Oregon. After Medicaid cuts happened in our state, there were thousands and thousands of people that used to work that were retired on disability benefits and received community-based services, including medications and other essential life-saving treatments. And as a result of those cuts, there have been 30,000 people die here in the state of Oregon who once worked and were surviving fine on state Medicaid benefits. But
Gwyneth, we're out of time. I have to just give Bernie a few seconds to respond.
I'm not familiar with the particular instance in Oregon, but I do know that Medicaid cuts have been disastrous and painful for large numbers of American people. And this indicates just the priorities of the Bush administration and the Republican leadership: tax breaks for billionaires and cutbacks in Medicaid. And that is morally reprehensible.
Amen. And Gwyneth, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening on KOPT in Eugene, Oregon. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org is website. Check it out. Bernie, thanks for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
You do such great work. Thank you. Coming up on the program, in the next hour, we're going to have Alex Epstein with the Ayn Rand Institute. In the third hour, we're going to be talking with Michael Ratner about Bush's plan for detention and eavesdropping. He's the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. It's going to be a fascinating day. Stick around. Of course, we'll be taking your calls and an awful lot of the news we'll be getting back to you. 57 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman radio program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, studies going all the way back to the 1950s, the early 1950s, show that there is no demonstrable relationship between an increase in the minimum wage and a loss of employment, an increase in unemployment. There's no relationship between an increase in the minimum wage and an increase in inflation. There is an increase, there is a relationship, however, between the increase in the minimum wage and a reduction in poverty. Bernie Sanders, in our last segment, in essence, gave high praise to our next guest, Alex Epstein. Alex is a junior fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Inasmuch as, Alex, you'll be interested to hear this from one of the most progressive members of the U.S. House of Representatives, I suggested to him that your position on the minimum wage was that it shouldn't be there, not because it works or doesn't work, but because it just shouldn't be a function of government. And Bernie said, you know, most of the conservatives in, most of the Republicans in the House of Representatives feel the same way. They just won't say it honestly. And so I commend you for your honesty if that is your position, Alex. Give us your take on it.
Oh, well, let me just say, the fact of something being a non-function of government and it, quote, working, it depends what you mean by work. But in the case of the minimum wage, it's absolutely indisputable that if you set the wage at a certain rate, it must increase unemployment. So let's.
But it never has.
Okay.
Not in the United States and not in any European country.
No. First of all, I've seen. I mean, those European countries have rife unemployment. So not exactly.
Not as a result of the minimum wage.
Well, those factors are hard to separate out. Okay, but if we increase them, I mean, why not increase the minimum wage to $30 an hour?
Why not increase taxation to 100%? There are, you know, why not drink 45 glasses of water a day if water's
well, no,
good for you?
There's a whole lot of things,
Alex, where a little bit in reason is reasonable and a whole lot, you know, wipes things out.
Yeah, but you're saying there's no causal relationship between an increase in the minimum wage and unemployment, and that, by the nature of it, it's not true because
no, I'm saying it's never been demonstrated.
Wages are, I don't believe that for a minute, and there are a million studies supposedly demonstrating the other. What the factors in the economy and doing these studies are very complicated because there are all kinds of different relationships. So the fact that one person says we raised the minimum wage and unemployment didn't skyrocket. Well, there are a lot of other factors that can make unemployment not skyrocket.
Actually, Alex, if you go back over the last 50 years and you look at the years in which the minimum wage increased, what you find is that unemployment over the following 3 years decreases. And the reason why is because when minimum wage employees get an extra 50 cents in their paycheck, when they get an extra couple thousand dollars a year in their paycheck, they spend all of it. Their spending of it stimulates the local economy, which creates demand for more goods and services, which creates more jobs.
Okay, well, that's raising a whole separate issue, which is who drives the economy. Is it consumers or producers? And it's definitely producers. Spending money does not create anything.
I'm not going to buy something just because somebody makes it. I'm going to buy it because I want it or because I can afford it. Are you trying to tell me that just because this is the rationale that Bush used in his silly idea that we should give millionaires and billionaires $550,000 and they'll create one job when he said
with a robust package of at least $550 billion and across the board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
You divide 1 million into $550 billion, it's $550,000 per job that Bush gave to millionaires and billionaires hoping that they would create jobs, and they did, in China. I mean, come on, you don't really believe that, do you, Alex?
Okay, well, let's get back to this, but it's not giving somebody money to take less of his money. It's not giving it to him. It's his money in the first place. And the fact that the government takes such a huge percentage of productive people's money and gives it to the unproductive is completely unacceptable.
It is not my money. It is not your money either, Alex. You and I both live in this society. We both use the public streets. We both use public. I'm assuming you used public education. I certainly did. We get clean water out of the tap. We have pure food. We are living in a society that we have contracted with by virtue of the fact that we haven't left this country, that we have contracted with to use the services that are available to us, and that means that we're obligated to pay for them. It's the equivalent of walking into a 7-Eleven, picking up a candy bar, taking a bite out of it, and then saying, you know, I'm not going to pay for this because it's my money.
No, we have rights by virtue of the fact that we are individuals. And so it is illegitimate for 51% of the people to vote away the rights of 49%, and it's completely illegitimate.
What does that have to do with your argument that taxes, that when government takes taxes, it's taking my money? I've contracted with that government.
It's your money by virtue of the – I'll take myself since you don't seem to value your money too much or even call it yours. I produce a product. Okay, I write articles. People pay me to write them because they value them. They place a certain value on them.
Sure.
I created that.
Yep.
That doesn't have anything. No one else has a right, no matter what they vote, to come in and take away my money. As far as what a government should do, the only thing it should do is protect me from other people coming and taking away my money. Now, that takes a certain amount of money, not very much, to have courts and a military and police. But there's certainly no right at all for anyone to set up to vote for a whole institution whose whole goal is to take away my money to pay for their kids' education or to pay for terrible roads that I have to drive on in California instead of private roads, or to pay for pay for people who can't afford retirement, or to pay for bad medical care.
But the fact of the matter, Alex, is that you and I live in a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic where we hire representatives by majority vote, and they decide these things.
Just like the representatives in Germany decided to appoint Hitler chancellor.
No, actually,
I don't regard that as
Hitler was not elected with a popular majority.
I didn't say he was elected. I said the representatives put him into power, but the Nazi Party certainly was elected by a plurality. So the fact that you get a mob of people, whether it's in Iraq or
America, it was only 33%.
Does not make it right. And the greatness of America used to be that it had limited severely the tyranny of the majority, as many of the founders called it. And unfortunately, we've become more and more democratic. So
you think that we should be an aristocracy rather than a democracy?
I don't know what you mean by aristocracy.
A rule by a small number of people, a meritocracy.
No, I don't think that it should be a matter of ruling. I don't think individuals should be ruled. I think the government is the servant of each and every individual and the safeguard.
So we should become a pure democracy like Greece, where it takes 6,001 people to show up to pass a law?
I said the exact opposite. The rights of the individual, which is not his right to vote, to violate the rights of others, but rather is his freedom to produce and act and think free of force
from
others.
If you don't think that, no, I understand that, Alex, and if you're saying that we shouldn't live in a democracy and that you're opposed to a pure democracy, free democracy like Greece had, and you're opposed to representative democracy, how do you and I mean, this is a practical question, not a rhetorical one. How do you and I make sure that, or we collectively as a society, make sure that the laws that are in place and the institutions that are in place actually reflect our desires?
What does it mean to actually, the fact that you desire something arbitrarily doesn't make it right?
Well, you want there to be a court system so that the corporation that buys your writing, if they don't pay you, you can sue them, right? You want that to be there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so that's part of government. Now, how do you and I make sure that that's there?
Enforce my rights. It's not a matter of whatever I arbitrarily desire.
No,
it's
I understand.
A matter of
well, perhaps it was a bad choice of words. But how do you and I make sure that that court is there so that you can seek redress if somebody publishes your work and refuses to pay you for it?
What do you mean? How do you make sure it's there? You set it up and you finance it.
So you set up your own court system, and then you expect the magazine to go along?
No, I don't set it. No, I'm sorry. I'm not an anarchist. I don't believe in individuals setting up their own court system. No, you have a court system that exists throughout the country. I mean, you
what,
have
it springs, it springs into being just by magic?
No, it's what do you mean? You establish a government like the founding fathers established a government. I don't understand what the question is. The issue
well,
is,
your original point.
Does the government protect rights as I advocate, or does the government violate rights for whatever the majority happens to desire, which is what you advocate? Those are the two alternatives. It's not anarchy versus.
No, there's a whole huge middle ground in between those two extremes, and those are straw man extremes, I would submit to you, Alan.
Well, okay, well, I disagree with all of those middle grounds. So getting back to the
How do we create a court system? Or for that matter, how do we decide what the rules of, well, to bring it back to the minimum wage, as you said, because we have about a half a minute here, and I'll give you the last word. How do we create a system where we decide how much people are going to be paid?
It's called freedom. You don't decide. You and I have no say on what anyone is paid except us and the people who work for us. So do they. And so it's like the price of anything else. It's determined by supply and demand. The more productive you are, the more you produce, the more you can get. And as far as the people who earn very little, it's very important for them to be able to get a job at the beginning so that they can earn whatever they can, and then they can develop their skills, which is what I did and which is what many other people do. And to price them out of the market doesn't help anybody and is a violation of everyone's rights.
So if an employer just says, you know, I'm paying $2, and they happen to be in an area where there's a lot of poverty and a lot of people competing for that $2, that's just fine.
That is not how prices work, and if they were, then they would pay everyone $2, but they can't because it's based on supply and demand, not whim.
Okay. Alex Epstein, Ayn Rand Institute, a junior fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Alex, great talking with you today.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting for a Change.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I got friends with low wages. Now, one thing I've learned, when Americans get burned, they won't just sit and complain. They know their rights to stand up and fight for jobs that are fair and humane. When those Walmart guys hear the word unionize, they go completely insane. They'll find out who, and boy, if it's you, you're in for a world of pain. Yeah, I got friends with low wages. They work for Walmart in outrageously bad conditions. 'Cause the union missed
it. And welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. The listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman radio program, brought to you today by our listeners supporting our sponsors, including the local sponsors you are hearing on your local affiliate. Please give them a call and thank them for advertising on the radio program and buy their products, support their company. And our national sponsor, Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, 1-800-425-2532. Their website, sacredgroundscoffee.com, and Small Dog Electronics. You can get the latest iPods now, 1-800-511-MAX, M-A-C-S, smalldog.com, their website. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, thanks for calling the Tom Hartman radio program. What's up?
Listening to your guest and listening to other objectivists and libertarians, they seem to be very much against rules, yet there are some rules where they adhere to more than anybody. And I'd be very curious, what are they, because they, you know, keep it saying, well, that's not right. What are those things, you know, what is that fundamentalist thing? What are those fundamental rules that they feel that you can never break? You know, what they keep talking about the individual.
Yeah, well, it rests on the, I don't want to, first of all, I'm not going to even try to speak for Alex. It wouldn't be fair to him, and I probably wouldn't do a good job of it. But my understanding of the libertarian, objectivist, and modern conservative viewpoint, and there are certainly a lot of differences between the three, but they have some of these things in common, is that they assert that the purpose of government should be to defend our rights, to basically, quote, live free and live free of government interference. And their idea of government interference is what they would call socialist programs like public education. I mean, how dare somebody who doesn't have children have to pay for somebody who does have children for the education of their children? That would be one of their positions. Now, on the other side, what I would say and what Americans have traditionally said is, the reason for this is that we all benefit from it. If we all have an educated workforce, if we all have people, you know, with a decent education and kids who are able to contribute to society, then we all functionally benefit from it. And that should be really the litmus test of any kind of legislation. Is this something that is going to benefit the majority of the people, or is this something that is only going to benefit a small minority? And this is, you know, one of the areas where actually I agree with a lot of the serious conservatives like Ron Paul, the Republican from Texas, that this government, particularly this Republican government, has run amok in giving away money to people like the oil industry and Halliburton and whatnot that in no way is benefiting the majority of people, no way is contributing to infrastructure or democracy in the United States, and is purely enriching a small number of people. And this is what Bernie Sanders identifies, is because of the need for campaign finance reform, things are going nuts.
Yeah. Well, what's ironic, it seems, when they're talking is they're so loose with so many things. You know, they reject so much, but yeah, they're such absolutists at the same time.
Yeah. Well,
the one thing that's been interesting talking to libertarians that none have ever been able to answer, and realizing he's an absolute, you know, an objectivist, not a libertarian, but how does any of that prevent a problem? It's kind of like bad medicine that has no preventive aspect, and no one's ever been able to answer satisfactorily how libertarianism prevents things.
No, it doesn't. It has to react to a harm. In other words, you don't stop people from emitting a poison until you see people die from it. You don't proactively do that. Yeah, good point, Jeff. Thanks for the call. Vic in Cedar Creek, Tennessee. Hey, or Texas, rather. Hey, Vic.
No, I wish I was in Tennessee.
Yeah.
I'd be glad to move.
Yeah. You could vote for Harold Ford this time.
Yeah. Well, Bernie would have had an ally had I got elected during the year Ross Perot ran in 1992. I too ran as an independent on a ballot.
Well, good on you, Vic.
For Congress. And I was defeated by Greg Laughlin, who later got beat by Ron Paul, who you just mentioned.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So
I disagree with Ron Paul on a lot of things, but I respect him for having a lot of integrity. He's one of the Republicans who speaks truth.
Yeah, but what I was going to ask Bernie, and I really wanted to ask you the same question. And I'm not new to this. I'm a first time caller and a new listener. You can thank Howard Stern for going on vacation too much, but so now I listen to you guys. But a quick search on the internet, you'll come across the USC Title 18, which talks about crimes, a lot of crimes against the federal government, and I think that...
There's a whole series of them. Vic, can you hang on for just a second?
Sure.
Can you hold on over the break? Because what you're speaking of is apropos to the piece that I have on commondreams.org today. And I suspect, and you know, I'd like to get your question out in full and get the answer out in full. So we'll be back with that. It's 27 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program. And we'll be back right after this.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Did my ballot go? Lock my faith in the government when they change the rules without my consent. Don't wanna be nobody's experiment. Wanna know where my ballot went? They locked my vote. I made my choice. Does anybody care to hear my voice? They locked my vote. Was that the plan? Nobody knows that I took a stand.
Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Speaking of the vote, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has a new article in the current issue of Rolling Stone magazine, the one that hits the stands, I guess it's like the October 5th issue or something, but it hits the web today. You can find it at rollingstone.com. The headline, Will the Next Election Be Hacked? The subhead, Fresh Disasters at the Polls, and New Evidence from an Industry Insider prove that electronic voting machines cannot be trusted. And a little later on in the program here, if we have the time today, I'll share with you a little bit of this article. He actually has a whistleblower inside Diebold who talks about how, the way I'm reading it, how the way they flipped the election in Georgia in 2002, which is something that I've been talking about literally since 2002. I first wrote about this in Common Dreams in either late 2002 or early 2003, that the polls were showing that Max Cleland won before the election. The polls showed that Max Cleland won after the election. It was the first time that the state of Georgia had used all electronic machines with no paper trail whatsoever, absolutely unauditable, and those electronic machines showed that, and this is what gave the Republicans control of the Senate back. The electronic machine showed that Saxby Chambliss, the Republican, who had never served in the military, who ran on a campaign that Max Cleland, who left three limbs in Vietnam, was not sufficiently patriotic, that Saxby Chambliss won by the exact same majority that all the polls were showing Max Cleland was ahead by. And I'm still, to this day, of the opinion that that election was illegally flipped in Georgia, and I think that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has the evidence right here in his article. Anyhow, we were talking with Vic in Cedar Creek, Texas.
Yeah, I'll try to get right to it. I'm too slow sometimes. But I guess my question was, who has standing? You know, it's obvious, or it's obvious to me that the Bush administration, or George Bush, if you want to pick out an individual, has at least appearance-wise and inferred by the Senate here recently, committed fraud against the United States.
Well, in the
now,
Supreme
what I
Court.
Want to know is who has standing to file charges. If there was a bank robbed and you're in a small town, and all of a sudden your neighbor got a new house and a Corvette, and you might rat him out to the local authorities and say, you know what, this guy might have robbed the bank. Well, I think George Bush might have committed a crime. Who, you know, Bernie talks a great game. Everybody's talking, but we're going to be stuck with these cats for more than two more years unless somebody files criminal charges on them. Even it's a misdemeanor to conspire to defraud the United States, and it looks like that's what they did.
Yeah, not only that, in the Hamden case, the Supreme Court ruled that the Bush administration had violated the Geneva Convention, and we have a law, a federal law, called the War Crimes Act, which
who can file a charge? Who can make that phone call? Who can go to the FBI office and say, guess what? You know, you got to have standing.
Yeah.
I guess you have to have been injured. You know, maybe one of your guests in the future can say, who can go to the FBI office and say, you know what, I want And I know it sounds comical. It's ludicrous.
No, I think it's quite serious. And in fact,
I think on the other hand that I'm witnessing criminal activity, the same maybe as people witnessed John Gotti doing on the streets of New York, and yet we're powerless to do anything about it. I mean, and our laws allow for prosecution of these.
Typically, Vic, it's the Justice Department that does that, but the Justice Department is complicit in this. I mean, it was Alberto Gonzalez, who's the head of the Justice Department, who wrote the memos, the torture memos, for example, that caused Bush to violate the War Crimes Act. It's a really good question whether or not individuals have standing, and 25 minutes from now on this program, we're going to have Michael Ratner on, who is the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And he is an attorney, and he has sued. I know he sued Rumsfeld, and in fact, when Rumsfeld went over to Germany 2 years ago, he went to Germany and filed charges in Germany against Rumsfeld and tried to have the German government arrest Rumsfeld when he showed up.
Well, since you're not on anymore on Sirius, I won't be able to hear an answer.
Well, you'll have to pick up the web stream, Vic. I'm sorry, but in any case, in 25 minutes we'll have Michael Ratner on, and I will ask him that question. So I appreciate the call and thank you very much for it, and step by step, on we go here. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hey, I wanted to get in when Bernie was on, but this kind of goes into...
I'm sorry, the phones... When Bernie comes on, the phones are just totally slammed and...
Right. No, this kind of dovetails in with your Ayn Rand guy. Basically, they're always trying to elevate economic system to a system of governance, and that's the bottom line. And every time you hit them with democracy, they fumble around. And
well, at least the Ayn Rand guys are up front. They don't believe in democracy.
Exactly.
But what I haven't been able to understand is what they believe in its place. I mean, how do you create a court system if you don't have a democracy to do it?
Well, they like pieces of democracy so long that it promotes their selfish ends, right? That's how they get around
well,
that.
But to their credit, I mean, I think we have to understand their worldview. They don't view it as selfish ends because they believe that society will be best served if everybody acts in their own self-interest. Now, there's no evidence of that. There has never been a successful libertarian society.
Right.
But that's their belief, and they're sticking to it.
But I like that you put them on there to expose that. That's good.
Thank you.
With Bernie, I think... You know, his analysis of why the working class doesn't vote, I think he missed a little bit. It's more fundamental and insidious that the Rove and the Republicans have convinced and hoodwinked working class that democracy of we the people equates to socialism. They really believe that. And an example is I was talking to a daycare lady, and I asked her, she told me her employer did not provide health care. And I said, well, yeah, we should... do like the other 36 industrial countries in the West and do it. And she goes, what, commie care? I don't want communist health care. And I said, no, those are democracies. They voted it in. And they don't even understand, they think we the people is socialism.
Well, part of the problem is, for example, when Hillary Clinton was advancing a program, Bill and Hillary Clinton were advancing a program back in, what was it, 93, 94,
right.
Which was, by the way, a 75% to 90% corporate program, with some government help, but it was a program that still would have left intact health insurance companies. It was not a radical program.
Right.
When they were advancing that, the mainstream media in the United States never, to the best of my knowledge, and I was paying attention back then to that, they never did a good profile on, for example, the differences between the German system and the British system so that Americans understood what the alternatives were. They never did a good profile on the Canadian system. Instead, it was all about politics as sports. Whose team is going to win, who's got the best ads, and frankly, the reason why, in my opinion, is because the mainstream media in the United States is no longer required by law to actually tell the truth and have news.
Yeah.
In fact, Fox News filed won a lawsuit against them by Steve, there's two reporters down in Florida who worked for Fox News, and they outed Monsanto. FoxRGBHlawsuit.com, I think, is the website, but if you Google FoxRGBH lawsuit, you'll get it. And these two reporters, a husband-wife team, did this study finding that there was some association, or there was some questions anyway, about a possible association between Monsanto's hormones that are injected into cows in Florida and cancer showing up in people. And the Fox station said, you have to change this story. And they said, you mean you want us to lie? And the Fox station said, yes, we want you to lie.
Right.
And they sued. And they were fired. They said, we won't lie. And so Fox fired them. So they sued for Jane Aker and Steve something are their names.
Mm-hmm.
And they sued, and and a jury of their peers unanimously ruled that Fox had unlawfully dismissed them. They had dismissed them without cause and that they'd be reinstated. Fox appealed that to the state appeals court and won. The appeals court said that under the current law, television news stations have no obligation to tell the truth. They can tell lies, and they can order their employees to tell lies. And that's the state of the law right now. That's where it's at.
Well, that's where Bernie was right on that about the corporate media. But the bottom line is that the Ayn Rand guys, like you say, have influenced the conservative thinking to hoodwink people to believe when the free market they think is democracy. Kevin Phillips talks about this in his book, Wealth and Democracy. They have confused the two different systems.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Tom. You're absolutely right. And thank you for pointing it out. Lonnie in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Lonnie, thanks for calling and listening to us on KOPT. What's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, I love your show, and I want to ask you a question aside from my other question. Is your new book screwed out in paperback?
No, it's out in hardcover.
Okay,
paperback will probably be a year down the road.
Well, I'm going to go get it then. Anyways.
It's in libraries, too, if you want to say
it. And Randian people and the far right, when they, because I help people with tax problems, that's my job, and, you know, many of the people say, well, we shouldn't be taxed. Well, the issue is, go to a country where there is no tax. My ex-husband is from Peru, and when I went down there, I was stunned at the level. There is no social responsibility.
I have worked in the slums in Lima, and even in the middle class parts of Lima, you worry about if people coughing on you with tuberculosis and kids
no
with guns.
Take a simple example. Look what Halliburton did in Iraq when nobody was looking. They didn't have any rules or regulation with our billions of dollars that they've lost.
Yeah.
Did they have social? Our soldiers were drinking bad water because no one was looking over their shoulders.
Right.
To me, these guys with the Ayn Randians, well, the government shouldn't be taking our money. The reason rich people agreed to that in the first place 70 or 80 years ago is because it was causing serious social problems and they couldn't get their money made.
Right. Well said, Lonnie. Very well said. Thank you very much. It's time now for our progressive, and thanks for calling in. Time now for our progressive pop quiz. Our question for the day in our progressive pop quiz, today's question is, what is RFK's, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s, new article in Rolling Stone magazine, the new issue out, rollingstone.com, what is it about? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-THOM, that's 1-866-440-8466, gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, and what we...
By Tom Hartman.
Yes, there you go, thank you. And what we can do about it. That's grim, Andrew. The answer coming up after the break. Sixth caller at 866-440-8466. The question, what's Bobby Kennedy Jr.'s new article in Rolling Stone magazine about? And we'll be back with that and talk radio news and your calls and Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Studies, Constitutional Rights will be with us after the top of the next hour. 46 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman radio program, exposing the con in conservatives.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Remember, democracy starts with you.
Tag your ears.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Welcome back, my friends. 51 minutes past the hour. We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Our question for the day, what is RFK's new article about? And congratulations to Robert Smart in Kamano Island, Washington. Robert knew that the answer is hackable voting machines. And you've got to check this thing out. It is a brilliant, brilliant piece of reporting. Really seriously brilliant. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Kevin in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I was listening earlier as a caller was talking about this notion of the crimes that the Bush family is actively engaged in. Yeah, and having standing. And I don't know how this works. I know that our Constitution is being twisted by these guys in new and unthinkable ways. And I don't know if there are provisions in the Constitution to protect the presidency from this very thing. But it seems to me that state's attorneys or maybe a city prosecuting attorney should be able to draw up some charges against any of the members of the administration on the local level and say, you know, when this man appears in this city or this state, we're going to have a warrant out for his arrest because he's violated the following laws of our state. Granted, he's done it from Washington, D.C., but, you know, there are states' laws that they are violating. I'm sure I can't think of specifically what they are at the moment, but I'm sure you could come up with a long list.
I think that there is some, you know, again, this is where not being a lawyer puts me at a bit of a disadvantage and something that we should ask Michael about because he is. But I believe that there is some sort of limit on how states can act against federal officials, people representing states. But,
yeah.
You know, I'm not sure. I think that a stronger standing would be me as a citizen. You know, that each one of us, you know, because the federal government has to be answerable to us as citizens. I'm not sure that it has to be answerable to the states, but it certainly has to be answerable to us. And if a federal official has violated a federal law, it would make sense that we would be able to do something. Now, I know some states have specific laws that allow this. For example, the way that Mark Caskey sued Nike in the case that went all the way to the Supreme Court last year, Caskey versus Nike, for essentially deceptive advertising, deceptive promotions. And Caskey's defense was, as a corporation, they have a First Amendment right to lie or to mislead or whatever, you know, some variation on that. The way that he was able to sue them is that California has a law that says that any citizen of California has standing and can act on behalf of or as if they were the state attorney general. And so he was able to sue Caskey in the state courts in California. I don't know if a state would require that kind of enabling legislation for lawsuits against federal officials, or if there is a federal version of that. I just don't know. I mean, maybe an attorney who knows will call in. But as I said, I'm going to be sure and ask Michael Ratner about that in about 10 minutes. So
It seems on a civil level that should be true, but I'm just curious if not whether you could test the Constitution in this very way if there was a Democratic. I know in some cities when we elect our district attorneys, I mean, some of them are clearly Democratic or Republican, even though they don't necessarily advertise that fact. But if there was someone who wanted to make a name for himself in the Democratic Party and take a party line position and say, we're going to charge George Bush and we're going to risk our political career on this very act and see where it goes. I mean, where is that brave individual who might try something like that?
Yeah. Well, Greg Gorman is with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Let's see if Greg knows. Greg, do you know and welcome to the program, Greg.
Always happy to be with you, Tom. You're going to have Michael Ratner on, huh?
We are, yeah, right after the break at the top of the hour. Is there any basis, if the Bush administration has actually committed crimes, if Bush has committed war crimes, if there's fraud against the American people, if, you know, if there are lies against us, whatever, you know, lying us into a war, do Americans have standing to sue?
Well, I know that there is no standing for, well, you know what, I'm not going to say no, I don't know, and I believe that something I've read or heard in the last few months has said that there's not, but I...
Well, it's a question we'll save for Michael. So what's going on in Washington, D.C., Greg?
Well, there's a few things going on, you know, two big things. This joint press availability with President Musharraf, who now I'm just going to go out and call a full-on dictator. I felt bad about using the word because, you know,
it's
that's
what he
is.
He overthrew a democratically elected government.
Exactly. You know what? Now I'm going to throw caution to the wind. I want to be more like you, Tom. I'm going to call him a dictator. I think the quote of the day, and I didn't hear the speech, actually. I've just been reading it. I was doing my first television show, actually, during the speech. He said, when asked about the Richard Armitage, you know, quote, about, you know, we're going to...
We would bomb them back to the Stone Age.
Bomb them back to the Stone Age if you don't help us in the terrorism thing right after 9/11. Well, it turns out, you know, and he says that on a 60-minute interview. You know, it turns out that when asked, he says, well, you know, I can't really talk about it. I'm honor-bound to Simon & Schuster. I've got a book coming out. I think it is so ridiculous that he used the word honor-bound to talk about a publisher when he seized control of his own country from its people in 1999, and now he's the president of Pakistan.
Right, yeah, amazing. Greg Gorman, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Greg.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
That's incredible. I'm honor-bound by my contract to my publisher. I'll have to use that sometime. That's a good one. You know, I have 19 books in print. If Musharraf can use it, I certainly can. We'll be back after the news. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. And special greetings once again this week to our new affiliates this week. KTNF in Minneapolis, Minnesota, KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, which is our home station, and The Quake, KQKE in San Francisco. And over the last 3 weeks, new affiliates KXIC in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and KOPT in Eugene, Oregon. Welcome. Michael Ratner is with us. He is the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, ccr-ny.org, the website. And Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here with us. The before we get into what's going on with Bush and his what I describe as the Bush get out of jail program, I don't know if you saw the piece that I published on Common Dreams this morning. One of our callers in the last hour, and we actually several callers weighed in on this, and I don't know, I'm not an attorney, and I believe you are, and you have attorneys working with you and for you. Who has standing to sue or attempt to stimulate prosecution of George W. Bush or members of the Bush administration for violations of U.S. law, for example, the FISA law or the War Crimes Act, or for that matter, you know, when Bush wrote the letter to Congress saying that Iraq was involved in 9/11, justifying his attack of Iraq, you know, it was a clear lie, and we now know it was. Who has standing to make that happen?
Well, a couple of things. If you're doing criminal prosecutions, trying to put a guy in jail, the only people who can bring criminal cases in the United States under federal law are U.S. attorneys, prosecutors. You can, you know, go out there and demonstrate and say, do it, but they don't have to do it.
So it'd have to be the Justice Department.
It has to be Justice Department, which, of course, is headed by Gonzales. Now, in the case of the president in particular, for crimes in office, he actually can't be prosecuted. He might be able to be indicted, but he can't be prosecuted. While he's in office, he has to be impeached. One of the reasons we haven't gotten any traction in this country, of course, is because you have the Justice Department controlled by Gonzales, you have the military justice system controlled by Rumsfeld, you have the torturers from Bush on down the line, obviously being getting away with it. It's one reason why at my office, actually, we went to Germany to try and get Bush and others indicted, or certainly the vice president and some of the others indicted, and we're planning to continue to do that. It's a very bad system in this country. In Europe, there's much more authority of individuals to go into a court and insist that they get prosecuted.
Interesting. Because I noticed that there was a news story on Common Dreams yesterday. It was a wire service story about a Republican, former Republican candidate for office from, as I recall, New Hampshire, who had tried to get a restraining order against George Bush from attacking Iran because she said that she would be harmed if he started a nuclear war.
Well, that's a different kind of case. That's a civil case. We've tried that many times. I think my office has brought 14 different cases to try and stop various kinds of wars. We've basically lost them all. We came close. One of them, they said you had to go to Congress to get the authority. You know, the courts can only, particularly on war issues, those are very difficult. When you get into criminal stuff and getting civil damages, you know, we have a case against Rumsfeld and others for what happened in Guantanamo with regard to torture. That case is proceeding, you know, quite slowly. Again, they put in a lot of roadblocks, and we'll see what happens. We have a case on behalf of that guy, Makar Arar, the Canadian citizen who was sent to Syria for torture. Again, it was dismissed initially, but we still expect on that case in particular, I expect that we'll make headway eventually.
We're talking with Michael Ratner. He's the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, ccr-ny.org, the website, and I recommend you check it out. Michael, on June 29, 2006, in the Hamden case, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Don Rumsfeld and the Bush administration had violated the Geneva Convention. That means that they violated the U.S. War Crimes Act and can be subject to to criminal prosecution. In fact, the Justice Department held a conference call, freaked out about this. 6 weeks later, August 17, 2006, federal judge Anna Diggs Taylor rules in Detroit that George W. Bush's administration committed numerous felonies with regard to the FISA Act, which carries a five-year prison term as its penalty. And she says explicitly that Bush has violated the Constitution, which is a breach of his oath of office, and carries impeachment as its penalty. What's the status of these? It seems to me that the Republicans are trying to, this so-called compromise, really what it is they're trying to keep George out of jail.
I mean, in some ways, what else is there to say? You just read the indictment and the impeachment. I mean, you got it here. Now, you look at this so-called compromise that everybody's hailing McCain about. There's a lot wrong with it. The first point that you're making, which is the point of your Common Dreams article, I think I haven't gotten to read it, but I knew you were working on it. The first point is that what they've done is they've amnestied. In other words, they've said you can't prosecute people for what they did in the past in terms of violations of the War Crimes Act. The War Crimes Act prohibits, makes criminal violations of Geneva Conventions. As you said in Hamden, all of a sudden these guys now realize, gee, we made all this torture stuff that we did in secret sites and in Guantanamo. What if some guy in the future wants to prosecute us? They were nervous. They actually said, I think one of the reasons they closed the CIA sites is they said, we're not doing this anymore.
Right.
We're out on a limb out there. We're not going to do this.
This is reported by the Financial Times, David.
Exactly. That's exactly the only place I saw it. I'm glad you picked that up. That's right. It was reported in the Financial Times. They're refusing to torture anymore. So what are they? They had a problem in the administration. These guys are very nervous. They're not sleeping at night. I'm going to get prosecuted. So the part of the McCain deal is to retroactively say that the War Crimes Act doesn't apply to any crimes that happened in violation of Geneva from 1997 forward.
Now,
that's illegal. I should say that is illegal. You know, when Chile tried it, when Argentina tried it during the Dirty War, you can't amnesty war crimes. You can't amnesty torture. It's a crime itself to do that. It's illegal, but of course in this country no one will care. But let me tell you, these guys, if they start traveling and people start going after them, they're going to be frightened of going into a lot of countries.
So it'd just be like Pinochet getting busted in England.
Absolutely. The other thing that I think is crucial about this act, and it's one reason
doesn't travel.
One reason I want people to visit our website is one of the things this new compromise does is it strips the federal courts of habeas corpus, which means that what you have is a right, if you're in detention, it goes back to the Magna Carta, to go into court and say, government, why am I being held? What this McCain bill does, Warner, McCain, administration, whatever you want to call it, is it says the courts can no longer hear the cases of anyone held in U.S. detention outside the United States, any non-citizen. Guantanamo, out. People in Bagram, out. Maha Arar, out. It basically puts into place executive detention, which is really, it's really a hallmark of a police state.
It is. I mean, it very much is. We're talking with Michael Ratner, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. The website's ccr-ny.org, a very important website. Write that down, keep track of it, and visit it regularly. Michael, what can we do about this? Bill Frist was bragging yesterday that if these guys didn't cave in, that he'd be able to bust a filibuster. I mean, Democrats are relatively impotent on this, aren't they?
You know, this is also sad. I mean, even I think it was Nancy Pelosi said today, well, we're following the lead of the Republicans. We're glad they did this. But it's all a fraud. It's all a fraud. They've stripped the courts of the right to habeas. They've said that they can't be prosecuted for past violations. They're narrowing the War Crimes Act going forward by excluding certain things. I read that as excluding things like hypothermia, where they take the temperatures down, stress and duress. They're saying the president can deal with Geneva and interpret it. I mean, this is no compromise. This is a sellout, and it's very sad. And when I think about our people in Guantanamo, 5 years there without yet having a court hearing, and that might go through, let me just say, the Democrats are, I know they feel strongly on this issue, actually. I just hope in the end that they stand up and really fight for getting people the right to go into court and test their detention. And what you can do about it is, one thing you can do is go to our website and get to your senators, and of course New York State, and I think they're with us, are Schumer and Clinton. I think they're fine on this habeas thing, but they got to make sure that people understand that we don't want our courts taken out of the process of holding people in detention.
This is a piece of legislation that needs to be filibustered.
Absolutely, that's what I think. But you know, will they have the nerve to do it? They all say, well, it's an election year. What do you want us to do? Well, we'll lose the next election. But they've got to get some backbone on these issues. I mean, for 5 years, this country has been engaged in torture and detention. entertaining people all over the world, and now they want to, when they get bad decisions, we won two decisions in the Supreme Court, the Razul decision in 2004 and the one you referred to, Hamden, in 2006, said we have the right to go into court and test people's detention. You can't just secretly hide them away. And now what Congress is doing at the behest of the president is really overturning those Supreme Court decisions.
It's essentially what Bush pushed through the UN 6 months after the illegal invasion of Iraq, because our invasion of Iraq did not comply with Resolution 1440. We got a retroactive approval for the invasion. I guess it worked in the U.N. They think they can do it in the U.S. Senate.
It's amazing to me. I mean, it is. I couldn't agree with you more. That's what they did. He basically went back and he said, well, now that they're allowing us to occupy Iraq, it's all legal, you know.
Right, yeah. I mean, and the U.N. rolled over, essentially.
But I think that they're going to have H to pay for this thing in the end. I mean, these guys really are war criminals.
From your lips to God's ears, Michael. Michael Ratner. CCR-NY.org, the Center for Constitutional Rights, CCR-NY.org, the website. Michael, the President, thank you for being with us, Michael.
And thank you for really getting to the issues. It's unusual on radio.
And for the great work you're doing, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Also. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the place where being progressive never felt so good. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And swinging from one emotional extreme to the other, let's check out what's going on with the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones. To fight and to die, and there are lies in the balance. There are people on the fire.
Following our security incidents and other developments in Iraq, reported on Friday as of 1100 GMT, residents of the Dateline Baghdad, this is from Reuters, by the way, residents of the religiously mixed Haraya district in northwest Baghdad clashed in mid-morning with gunmen who set two houses on fire, according to the Interior Ministry. Firefighters, when they came to tackle the blazes, were fired upon. Also in Baghdad, police found 10 bodies, including those of two women in different parts of Baghdad. Most bore signs of torture and had been shot. The two women were found in the western Shiite district of Shula. None of the bodies was immediately identified. In Mosul, police found two bodies, one beheaded in the western part of that city. In Kirkuk, police found a woman's body dumped by the side of the road in a small town of Taza. In Dhanwania, three gunmen in a car opened fire and killed Nomas Atut, a former Ba'ath Party member near his house in that city. And in Baghdad, one U.S. soldier was killed late on Thursday after the vehicle he was traveling in was struck by a roadside bomb in eastern Baghdad, according to U.S. military sources. Today, by the way, I think I opened the show saying it was September 21. It's just September 22. On this day in history, Nathan Hale was executed in 1776. This guy, he was a school teacher. He was 22 years old, as I recall. I'll look through here and see now this little article I have about it doesn't tell, but I'm pretty sure that Nathan Hale was 20. He might have been as much as 24 years old, but he was a young guy. He had been a school teacher. And in late September of 1776, he volunteered to cross the British lines and travel into Long Island to gather intelligence. He was discovered, captured by the British. General Howe took him to his headquarters in New York City. On September 22nd, he was interrogated and hung, executed. Captain William Hull of the Continental Army was present, of George Washington's army, and lived to tell the story. And he wrote this about it. He said, in a few days, an officer came into our camp under a flag of truce and informed Hamilton and a captain of the artillery, but afterwards the aide of General Washington, that Captain Hale had been arrested within the British lines, condemned as a spy, and executed that morning. I learned the melancholy particulars from this officer, who was present at his execution and seemed touched by the circumstances attending to it. He said that Captain Hale had passed through their army, both of Long Island and New York, and then he tells the whole story of how he was arrested. When apprehended, he was found with papers concealed upon his person that betrayed his intentions. He at once declared his name, rank in the American Army, and his object in coming within the British lines. Sir William Howe, without the form of a trial, gave orders for his execution the following morning. He was placed in the custody of the Provost Marshal, who was a refugee and hardened to human suffering and every softening sentiment in the heart. Captain Hale, alone, without sympathy or support, save that from above, on the near approach of death, asked for a clergyman to attend him. It was refused. He requested a Bible. That was refused. On the morning of the execution, continued the officer who was there and saw it, my station was near the fatal spot, and I requested the provost marshal to permit the prisoner to sit in my marquee while he was making the necessary preparations. Captain Hale entered. He was calm and bore himself with gentle dignity in the consciousness of rectitude and high intentions. He asked for writing materials, which I furnished him. He wrote two letters, one to his mother and one to a brother officer. He was shortly after summoned to the gallows, but few persons were around him. Yet, as I stood there, I heard his characteristic dying words. Nathan Hale, on this day, in 1776, as he was being hung, said, I only regret that I have but one life to lose for my country. Today, the execution of Nathan Hale. Will the next election be hacked? Bobby Kennedy goes after this. It's in Rolling Stone magazine, and you can see it over at rollingstone.com. There are some absolute bombshells in this article by Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., and I'll share a few of those with you when we come back from the break. It's remarkable. Plus, we'll be taking your calls at 1-866-440-8466. 27 minutes past the hour. Right here on the Tom Hartman radio program, the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
If I had one prayer to pull out, seeing it, everyone, everywhere would be happy. Yeah, we'd hand out.
And welcome back, Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank, 34 minutes past the hour. Will the next election be hacked? Will it be? Was the last election hacked? I'm telling you, 2002 was definitely hacked in Georgia. You cannot convince me otherwise. The evidence is just so overwhelming. Yeah, yes, it's all circumstantial. Why? Because the machines are unauditable. The silicon, you know, turn off the power and boop, evidence is gone. The evidence is gone. Anyhow, it's but Robert F. Kennedy Jr. here has laid this thing out. Here's just a couple jewels from his article in Will the Next Election Be Hacked? In the current issue of Rolling Stone, rollingstone.com. In Tarrant County, Texas, He says electronic machines counted some ballots as many as six times, recording 100,000 more votes than were actually cast. In San Diego, poll workers took machines home for unsupervised sleepovers before the vote, leaving the equipment vulnerable to tampering. And in Ohio, a government report uncovered large and unexplained discrepancies in vote totals recorded by machines in Cuyahoga County. And then he tells the story of a guy by the name of Chris Hood, an African-American whose parents fought for voting rights in the South during the 60s. He was proud to be working as a consultant for Diebold Election Systems, helping the company promote its new electronic voting machines. During the presidential election 2 years earlier, more than 94,000 paper ballots had gone uncounted in Georgia, almost double the national average. And the Secretary of State was under pressure to make sure every vote was recorded properly. Hood was there in May of 2002 when the officials signed the contract. He wondered why Diebold had been awarded the contract. And then it goes, Robert F. Kennedy goes through this whole thing about it looks like it was an inside deal. And, you know, why was the president of Diebold checking his stock prices as all this was going on? And you know, the shady stuff of that. But then it gets even weirder. Then one muggy day in mid-August, Hood, this is the story of Chris Hood. He's the whistleblower from Diebold. He was down there in Georgia, the 2002 election. Then one muggy day in mid-August, August, September, October, November, what is it, 3 months before the election, Hood was surprised to see the president of Diebold's election unit, Bob Yurosevich, arrive in Georgia from his headquarters in Texas. With the primaries looming, Yurosevich was personally distributing a patch, a little piece of software designed to correct glitches in the computer program. "We were told," said Hood, "that it was intended to fix the clock in the system, which it didn't do. Curious thing is the very swift and covert way this was done." He says it was an unauthorized patch, and they were trying to keep it a secret from the state. "We were told not to talk to county personnel about it. I received instructions directly from Yurosevich. It was very unusual that the president of the company would give an order like that and be involved at that level." End of quote. Back to what Bobby Kennedy wrote. According to Hood, Diebold employees altered software in some 5,000 machines in DeKalb and Fulton counties. Now, these are the two primary counties that make up the city of Atlanta, the state's largest Democratic strongholds. To avoid detection, Hood and others on his team entered warehouses early in the morning. Quoting Hood again, Chris Hood, the good guy, the whistleblower, who apparently was part of hacking the 2002 vote in Georgia, he says, "We went in at 7:30 in the morning. We're out by 11. There was a universal key to unlock the machines. It's easy to get access. We've talked about that in this program. You can open a Diebold machine with a minibar key. The machines in the warehouses were unlocked. We had control of everything. The state gave us the keys to the castle, so to speak, and they stayed out of our way." Hood, end of quote. Hood personally patched 56 machines and witnessed the patch being applied to more than 1,200 others. The patch comes on a memory card that is inserted into a machine. Eventually, all the memory cards ended up on a server that tabulates the votes, where the patch can be programmed to alter the outcome of an election. Quoting Hood again, "There could be a hidden program on a memory card that adjusts everything to the preferred election results. Your program says, I want my candidate to stay ahead by 3 or 4% or whatever. These programs can include a built-in delete that erases itself after it's done." End of quote. From the former Diebold employee Chris Hood. Then as Bobby Kennedy writes, "It is impossible to know whether the machines were rigged to alter the election in Georgia. Diebold's machines provide no paper trail, making a recount impossible. But the tally in Georgia that November surprised even the most seasoned political observers. 6 days before the vote, polls showed Senator Max Cleland, a decorated war veteran and Democratic incumbent, and I'll tell you, from having lived 13 years in Georgia, wildly popular in the state, leading his Republican opponent, Saxby Chambliss, who, by the way, was a draft dodger, but he was the darling in the Christian coalition, by 5 percentage points. In the governor's race, Democrat Roy Barnes was running a decisive 11 points ahead of the Republican Sonny Perdue. But on Election Day, Chambliss won with 53% of the vote and Perdue won with 51% of the vote. Now, Robert Kennedy won't come out and say this, but I will. That's impossible. It just doesn't happen. Kennedy writes, "Diebold's response has not been made public, but its machines remain in place for Georgia's election this fall. Hood says it was, quote, common knowledge, end quote, within the company that Diebold also illegally installed uncertified software machines used in the 2004 presidential primaries a charge the company denies. Hood left the election consulting business and became a whistleblower. What I saw, he said, was basically a corporate takeover of our voting system. And that's what I've been saying. This is, you know, it's wrong that we've got voting machines that are unstable. It's criminal that we have turned the commons of the vote, the commons by which all the other commons are administered, over to a private corporation. That's absolutely criminal. By the way, Sean, I thought Sean was going to hang on the line. Apparently he didn't, but Sean in Indiana called and gave us a new toll-free number to get to the Capitol. And Lauren has checked it out. It actually works. 1-866, write this down, David. 1-866, and write this down, listeners. 1-866-808-0065. And we'll check that out. You can check it out and call your members of Congress. Actually, now is the time to call your senator and say, do not, please filibuster, or at the very least, do not vote for this so-called compromise that ends habeas corpus in the United States and that grants a free pass on war crimes to the Bush administration. If it's a Democrat, ask for a filibuster. If it's a Republican, say, please do not vote for this so-called compromise, this so-called McCain compromise. It is wrong. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Alan in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT. Hey, Alan.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, last time I voted, I was very upset about the voting machines, the touchscreen machines, and I was complaining about it from the moment I walked in. I unfortunately had already touched the screen once, because I didn't think there was going to be any alternative. But as I complained more to sympathetic ears, by the way,
mm-hmm.
I said, you know, can't I just have a paper ballot? And they said, oh, actually you could have, but you've already touched the screen. And once you touch the screen, that has to go through. And I said, are you telling me then that if I come next time and don't touch the screen but do, in fact, request a paper ballot, that I can have one? And they said yes.
Yeah. And that's basically an absentee ballot. Yeah.
So my question is, I was almost planning on standing out there with my own sign saying, ask for a paper ballot.
Right. Here's the that's the upside. The downside is it doesn't much matter as long as there's a lot of electronic votes. You know, if they're going to rig a machine, they'll rig around that. For example, in the Busby-Bilray race in San Diego, my understanding is that the race was called and certified before they even had opened the paper ballot because the machine said that the margin of victory was greater than the probable number of votes on the paper ballots. So, I mean, this is a cancer that has to be cured. Yes, we have to show up in absolute mind-boggling record numbers. Yes, we have to get active, but it's not a solution. It's a good step. It's really a good way of registering your upset with the elections officials. You know, when they hear of a lot of voters saying, "I'm just not going to use this machine. Give me something else." Then it's possible that things will change. But Alan, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. 1-866-440-8466. Leonard in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Leonard.
Hi there, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
I'm an ex-programmer who lost their position due to the goings of the economy. I drive a wine truck now. But you're absolutely right, and Mr. Kennedy's absolutely right. These things can be hacked. They're access databases. They are architectural decisions can be made so that you can put in functions that would guarantee you would win by a random amount of votes.
Right.
That's one thing I'd like to say. I listened to your segment on Bernie Sanders every Friday, and you mentioned Karl Rove so many times that I'm still trying to find out what Karl Rove is doing with the reconstruction of Katrina.
Yeah, he's right. He was put in charge of that.
He's put in charge of that, and yeah. I can't find out anything.
Well, he's a political operative. What he's doing is he's making sure that African-American Democratic voters can't vote, that they can't come home, and and running the FEMA camp where 70,000 of them are locked up next to a refinery, as far as I can tell. Thanks for the call, Alan. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white. The bright, blessed day, dark, sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Andrew Dunn and Lauren Kirshner at Air America Radio, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society and RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, which are running a little behind right now. We're trying to get the server upgraded because we've got hundreds of gigabytes of data on there right now, and we've hit a limit, so we're working on it. The server's in London, so it's taking a little time. And to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to those of you who listen to our program and support it, thank you so much. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jimmy in Sacramento, California, KSAC. Hey, Jimmy.
Good morning. Or afternoon, or evening.
Yeah, almost afternoon. What's up?
Okay. I listened to your talk with the person from the Ayn Rand Institute.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if there are very few libertarians complaining about the constitutional excesses of this government, and it seems to me that they've, like, you might say, have sold their souls to the conservative movement in order to get their economic agenda passed.
Well, there's some of them who are pretty outspoken, like Ron Paul, for example.
One of the exceptions.
But go ahead. You were saying.
Yeah, and turning a blind eye to the limitations on civil liberties.
Yeah, I don't hear, who's the phony reporter with, I think it's ABC, forgetting his name. In any case, yeah, there's a bunch of libertarians out there that I'm not hearing.
Yeah, I heard
John
Richard Viguerie. I heard Richard Viguerie talking about how this government under these neocons was immoral, but refused to say that it was violating the Constitution.
Yeah, no, and they clearly are. Jimmy, thanks a lot for the call and for pointing that out. Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Joe.
Yes. First, I want to let the listeners in the Portland area know about Aaron Russo's movie coming to Portland next week on September the 29th at the Clinton Street Theater.
Yep, and by the way, also for our listeners in the Portland area, on Wednesday of next week, there's going to be a movie at the Baghdad Theater, This Land Is Your Land, which features Jim Hightower, 11 other folks, and me. And I'll be there with Laurie Cheadle, the producer and director, doing a Q&A afterwards. It's at the Baghdad Theater on Wednesday night.
Cool. I was thinking of, in connection with Bill Maher, being banned by CBS, I was wondering, if Robert Kennedy Jr. wanted to get up on the CBS Evening News and talk about vote fraud, if they would let him, or if that would fall outside of their free speech zone there on CBS.
Yeah, I think it's safe to assume, Joe, that it's unlikely, although you never know. I mean, he may end up on a CBS show. I mean, maybe he'll be on Jay Leno or something. Who knows? But, the whole story of his firing is really tragic. Cher in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Cher.
Yeah, there were two programs, Ring of Fire programs, that I heard that Robert Kennedy Jr. and Bob Papantonio were were going to sue the George Bush and
yes.
his bunch. What suit is that?
We had Bobby Kennedy on this program 3 weeks ago, something like that, and at that point they were going to file. I don't know if they have, and so I'm going to have to do some follow up on that and get back with you, Cher. I just don't know. And of course, you can listen to their program on the weekend, and probably their blog over at AirAmerica.com will tell you.
Well, here in Seattle, they have the Cougars playing every Saturday now, so I don't get to hear them anymore.
Well, go to AirAmericaRadio.com or AirAmerica.com, and there's a blog, you know, a listing on their They have each show has a homepage, and there's information there. I would guess that you can get something there, and David's working on it right now. We're going to try and get Bobby Kennedy on the program to talk about the article that he has in Rolling Stone. Maybe we can get him on next week and ask him that very question.
Oh, great!
So, Cher, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Nice to hear from you, Armin in Florida. Hey, Armin in Bradenton, Florida.
Hey, you know, Tom?
Yes, sir.
I can almost, in retrospect now, hear Reagan telling Gorbachev, "Mr. Gorbachev, your version of totalitarianism is never going to work. Your people are too educated. Let us show you how to create a totalitarian state with wealthy, religious, and corporate backing."
Well, they certainly have moved down that road a long way in the last 26 years, Armin, but I really don't believe that the American people are going to let them go much farther. We are seeing a nationwide, not just a worldwide pushback, but a nationwide, an awakening in the United States. We may not succeed in this election, but we are waking people up. And step by step, Armin, I got to say, you know, I know that you're a bit of a pessimist. I'm a lot of an optimist. Even if we lose elections, and hopefully we won't, but even if we do, I think that we need to move forward with this thing, and we can. So,
Tom?
Yeah. You got 10 seconds, Tom.
Isn't it amazing? The Republicans are all about collectivism for the benefit of the millionaires and billionaires, the least needy in society.
Yeah, it is. It really is. Armin, thanks for the call. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up on Monday's program, I'll be debating conservative Daniel Merrick on Republican economic policies, demonstrating how to talk back to right-wing talking points. That and more, and your calls, right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States. Remember, my friends, democracy and activism begin with you. Tag, you're it. See you Monday.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.